On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Business Week magazine loves to write about American winners, about brilliant business strategies and American companies taking on the world. This week, Business Week's cover story has a little different flavor. Its headline is The Poverty Business, and it's all about American companies zealously targeting America's working poor as a new profit center. With sky-high interest rates and gotcha deals, no self-respecting middle-class American would dream of taking. The formula, need plus desperation equals big fat profits. Up next on Point, how it works, growing rich on the poor. Joining me from Washington is Keith Epstein, investigative reporter with Business Week and co-author of this week's cover story, The Poverty Business. Keith, thanks for being with us.
Hi, Tom.
And with us from New York is Paul Barrett, assistant managing editor at Business Week and lead editor on the story. Paul Barrett, thanks very much for joining us.
I'm glad to be here.
So we saw this cover story, a head-turning headline, in kind of an unexpected venue, The Poverty Business Inside U.S. Companies' Audacious Drive to Extract More Profits from the Nation's Working Poor. That's on the cover of your magazine, and we thought, wow, let's take a look. Keith, let me go first to you. What's going on here?
What's going on here is that this is more than just a business story, but it's certainly a business story. There was a time when once upon a time, substantial businesses had little interest in going after customers who had relatively little in their pocket, a few dollars. In recent years, there's a whole range of businesses that have found ways of making financing more readily available to people at the lower end of the economic spectrum, making computers, bringing computers within their reach, bringing hearing aids within their reach, bringing homes, as we know from the subprime mortgage story, to them. Credit cards, and what have you. This remaking of the marketplace has many aspects to it. There are people who talk about this as a much-needed advance in bringing access to these sorts of things to people who couldn't avail themselves of it in the past. Mm-hmm. Others say there's a darker side to this. And we took a look at some of the more innovative firms that lured some unsophisticated shoppers by the thousands, into a thicket of debt that is hard to escape.
As you write, innovative and zealous firms have lured unsophisticated shoppers by the hundreds of thousands into a thicket of debt, as you say, from which many never emerge. Paul Barrett, we're trying to figure out what exactly is new here. In any time, in any place, if you buy what you can't afford and get into debt, you can get yourself in trouble. So what's new that makes it worth putting on the cover?
One thing that's new is the size and sophistication of the companies involved, and that was one of our main focuses. As you mentioned in your open, I mean, payday loan outfits have been around for some time, but now these payday loan outlets are being rolled up into very large companies that can operate much more efficiently. Similarly, it's not big news that there would be a used car dealer in town, but we looked at a used car company that has outlets all over the country and has plans for 300 more and uses extremely sophisticated proprietary software to figure out just how much it can charge people in terms of the price of the car so that they can maximize the monthly payment on the car. So a big part of what's new is the scale of the companies, the sophistication of the techniques they're using, and the number of people that they're reaching. And the overall effect is really what amounts to a huge borrowing binge by working poor families, with the amount of debt that they are holding going way, way up. Salaries for such people have been stagnant for decades. They're spending more, and they're making up the difference by borrowing a lot more. And the bottom line is really a question, not one that we can firmly answer, but a question about whether all of this is potentially putting more goods and services in the hands of working poor people, but at the cost of possibly retarding overall upward mobility. And that's the real reason this deserves attention.
So upward mobility, a kind of key piece of the American story, that's the way we always understand it and see it. It's part of the social compact here. But Keith, you describe businesses looking at this as a great big opportunity. If the poor are so stretched in their borrowing, why does it represent such an opportunity? That doesn't sound like a great credit risk.
Well, you're right. What's happened, one of the big changes here, as Paul mentioned, is the advent of technology. There are a lot of ways that companies can now, with a very relatively little effort, except on the front end, be able to assess the risks of dealing with a particular customer. This gets very sophisticated. I mean, there are things that we've all heard of, such as being able to use the internet, all kinds of data online, not just credit scores, but other things. But this goes well beyond. Also, we all know about electronic deposits, how that can speed transactions and reduce the transaction cost to companies. What's also going on is an increased sophistication. For instance, one of the companies we looked at, a credit card company, has a 55-member team that they call an analytics and modeling team. Mm-hmm. My colleague Brian Groh took a look at some of this. This team includes PhDs, former university professors, some numbers gurus who tend to go by who are called quant jocks, the kind of people who you might think in your imagination would be the kind of people who would be more engaged in work in Houston, sending a spacecraft to the moon.
Yep.
But what they're doing is they're sifting through 2 terabytes of data in this cavernous computer center near Atlanta.
About essentially the poor.
What they've done is they've been able to go through this data, and you can assess, even with somebody who has a poor credit rating or no credit rating, the kind of risk that you face, and be able to therefore establish the terms by which you're dealing with the clientele, being able to reach this has brought down the total cost of being able to reach this new demographic.
So on the one side, you've got poor, maybe not tremendously well-educated Americans sort of trying to get by, desiring things maybe that they can't afford or things they need, a car to get to work. On the walking in to buy the, on the other side, you've got rocket scientists with terabytes of data and supercomputers figuring out, in a way, how to juice them, as you describe it.
Well,
much of it is very sophisticated, and much of it is surprisingly simple. We looked at a reseller of computers and televisions, which has a new twist on the traditional rent-to-own approach.
This is the company Blue Hippo
Blue Hippo asks people right up front for their checking account information, immediately takes a relatively substantial payment, and then begins to collect periodic payments, at least several of them, before even moving toward shipping the computer.
And this is direct withdrawal. So you're in their system, and they're sucking out their payment before you've got the computer.
Precisely. And they would say what we're doing is we're making sure this person is in a position to actually make these payments before we complete the sale. But from the consumer's point of view, you frequently have a situation where people end up getting frustrated, try to cancel the transaction, but have already paid some money in which they never get back. And we interviewed people, former employees of the company, who confirmed that this was really a pattern that they had seen over and over again.
The Blue Hippo knew very well, so they could anticipate cash in their pocket from these people, knowing they'd likely never ship the computer.
Right. Well, that's the allegation. The company, of course, denies this and says that this is all out in the open, and their method is simply to make computers and televisions available to people who have terrible credit and otherwise wouldn't be able to buy them elsewhere. We profiled one man who had been a customer, and the simple fact was that if he had really shopped around a lot more diligently, he might have been able to purchase a computer elsewhere of the similar quality. But some of the responsibility for this problem lies on the shoulders of the consumers, who don't always shop around for the best deal. And companies that are aware of that can sometimes benefit from it. We should throw in one other important financial background, a piece of background, and that is the larger availability of financing for these companies. We're in a situation where Wall Street has learned how to package together debts and resell them as securities to big investors like hedge funds and insurance companies.
Right, right.
And some of the debts that accumulate in the hands of the companies that we analyzed are resold on Wall Street, providing more funds for the companies to go out and continue operating.
So there's a huge amount of liquidity there, looking for a place to go. It's going to the
poor.
Exactly. But here's this. In 1989, as you report, households earning $30,000 or less a year paid an average annual interest rate on auto loans, let's just say, that was 16.8% higher than households earning more than $90,000 a year. Okay, we know if you don't make as much, you're a greater risk, you're going to pay more. But you point out by 2004, that discrepancy had soared to 56% higher. You quote the former chair or the chairman of the Federal Deposit Insurance Company saying, it's not only that the poor are paying more, the poor are paying a lot more. Why is that, Keith?
Well, the poor, for one reason, poor are paying more because we're all paying more.
Interest rates are pretty low these days.
I'm sorry?
Interest rates are historically low these days.
Interest rates are low unless you're living in a place where you don't have access to the kind of financial services that you and I do, or if you fear going into a bank because you think you're going to be rejected. There is a bit of a stigma about that out there.
Right.
Or if you don't realize, there were a number of people we talked to who really did not understand the basic concept of interest, and people within this industry acknowledge that they have customers coming to them who are looking more at the immediate need or the immediate want in some cases.
So on one side of the curtain, all the sophistication of Wall Street brought to bear. On the other side, I don't know, the cleaning lady in New Mexico who needs to get to work. Keith Paul, I couldn't help but recall the story that came out a couple years back of the huge number of payday loan outfits clustered around the gates of American military bases, where U.S. soldiers don't get paid a lot, and lots of soldiers going in, you know, to get an advance on their paycheck, where they would see interest rates of 400, 700, 800%. When that came out and was reported in some depth, I mean, Congress got all over it. The Pentagon put limits on it. Legislation came in behind it. You had Republican Senator John Warner saying Congress has an absolute responsibility to protect members of the military and their families from such unfair practices. Keith, most Americans don't have that kind of shepherd standing over them.
That's right. And payday lending, despite the attention it's gotten on the Hill, and it's getting even in places in state capitals across the country, is still doing fairly well from the business perspective and still making quite a few loans in places like New Mexico. New Mexico, and many of those businesses are, by the way, owned big out-of-state businesses. It's not necessarily your neighborhood locally owned payday lender anymore. Gallup, New Mexico, you talked about outside military installations.
Yeah.
Well, Gallup, New Mexico is just outside of a Navajo Indian reservation in western New Mexico.
Mm.
And there are, I think the latest number is something like one payday lender for every 450 residents.
That's all over the place with these super high rates. The military now has a limit of, I think, 36%. Congress has helped them put on what soldiers will pay for payday loans. But are these hundreds and hundreds of percent annualized loans still the norm?
There is still quite a bit of that. And of course, there are payday lenders out there, and their association will tell you that they believe strongly that they're providing a service, a much-needed service. And they point to the example of if you are poor, for instance, as we're in the case of some of the people we talk to.
Right.
There are moments when you are very close to the edge, and you need that extra money. You need a quick infusion of money, or you may not be able to pay your rent, and you may be kicked out of your apartment.
And then there's student lending, where more and more of student loans have gone to private companies instead of the government. And you write about people getting trapped. You know, they're told lifetime education, go back to school, gear up for the globalized economy. They do that, and they're trapped essentially for the rest of their lives because these loans don't go away with bankruptcy protection, and their interest rates can also be very high.
That's right. We talked to a woman in Washington State who actually has, you would think, managed to get herself back on her feet. She works from home as a computer programmer. She's in her 40s, but she is still saddled with a six-figure now debt on her student loan from roughly 20 years ago. At a time when she had been released from the foster care system, had done well in math in high school, had a chance to study computer science and took out a loan, thinking this was her way up.
Now, she may feel alone in that, but again, the reporting we've seen points out that Wall Street knows very well what's going on. Sallie Mae, the big lender, used to be government-related, now pretty much private, and it makes a lot of these loans. Recently, a $25 billion buyout by J.C. Flowers, the big private equity firm, because in no small part here, I'm looking at Fortune magazine, they say, because J.C. Flowers said, look how what high interest rates they can make on these private loans to students.
Well, this is regarded, some of this is regarded as quite an impressive field. I mean, Cerberus, the private equity firm that is in the news now for having bought a fair chunk of Chrysler, also investor in General GMAC, the auto financing arm of General Motors, a chunk of which is engaged in subprime lending.
Paul, your story points out that marketers, many times the product that's out front, whether it's a car or a computer or a television or an education, the product is just a kind of hook to get less well-off shoppers into these very expensive loans. And that's very much how the businesses see it. It's just it's the hook, the come on, the lure.
Right. We spoke to and profiled a large chain of used car dealerships, which are not at all like you might picture your traditional used car dealerships. This is a very proficient, very successful company. And one of their franchisees just said to us explicitly that we're basically in the finance business. The car just happens to be the commodity that we put out front.
Keith, tell us the story, if you would. You mentioned New Mexico. Tell us the story of Roxanne Soucy. She's on the cover of Business Week this week. She makes about $15,000. Tell us the story of her trying to get to work, getting a car. What happened?
That's right. This is Roxanne Soucy is a Navajo woman who lives in Albuquerque, New Mexico. And she lived with her mother in a poor part of town known as the War Zone. Her mother wanted to go back to the reservation and live in a house without any electricity or running water.
Yep.
She wanted a different kind of life. She wanted to establish some independence. She wanted to be, as she says, a good model, role model for her children. Mm. She has four children. And so she got a job as a home health care aide.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't pay a lot. These are the people that, as you probably know, Tom, are the people who go around and have the task of taking care of older people, very sick people. It's a hard job.
Feed them, turn them in their beds, help them clean up. Yep.
That's right. And to do that in a place like Albuquerque, you mentioned a while ago, well, this idea that maybe some of your listeners might think that the poor ought to walk to work. Mm-hmm. Well, in a place like Albuquerque, New Mexico, that really isn't possible. It's a vast sprawl over a fairly big expanse of desert, and you need a car. And to get a car, she didn't feel there were many places she could go where she would be sold a car.
Yep.
No credit history to speak of, mm-hmm. hadn't held a job before, and went to a dealership near her where she lived in the war zone of Albuquerque, New Mexico, and got very excited about a car they showed her after going, and they went over her budget with her and what she spends on various things, and she was able to drive away that day in a car. And
1999 Saturn subcompact, and she was thrilled.
That's right. Had 103,000 miles on it, and she was thrilled. And shortly thereafter realized that the payments were too much for her, that she had thought it would be $150 a month. In fact, it was $150 every other week, just more than she could bear. And had to bring it back.
But she had walked away thinking $150 a month. And on the other side of this used car lot, a big company who specializes in doing exactly this kind of sales called BuyRider. How does BuyRider work, Paul?
Well, I think the key thing to focus on is BuyRider's method of figuring out how much they're going to charge people. Unlike your conventional car dealership, the price is not on the window of the car in a clear way. In fact, the price is not necessarily the final price is not necessarily calculated until the dealer figures out how much he thinks you can pay.
Right.
So they're basically maximizing the price based on what they think the maximum monthly or twice monthly payment that will fit into your budget.
And they analyze opportunity pricing, that's often called, and it means opportunity for the seller, not the buyer.
Yeah, that's very true. And you end up with situations like the one that Keith was just describing, where the consumer is basically pushed to the very, very maximum of what, in theory, they can squeeze out of their monthly their monthly income, and in connection with all of their other expenses. And as I think people could easily guess, this frequently puts people right on the edge or pushes them over the edge. In the case in New Mexico that Keith was describing, I mean, Keith was out there, went to the dealership, confronted the person who runs the dealership, who sat down behind the computer, looked at this particular case, and said, well, we gave her all the information she needed. We communicated everything. Keith basically said, look a little closer. Mm-hmm. He looked a little closer and he said, well, actually, you're right. We should never have made a loan to this person of this magnitude. Our apologies. We'll give her the money back that she paid in. But the point we made.
But not everybody has a Business Week reporter standing over the guy who sold them the used car with the big national company with this specialty.
Precisely. And while in New Mexico, the state attorney general's office has looked at these practices and decided that while they're not necessarily particularly savory, on the other hand, they didn't think that they were illegal. Attorneys general in other states have thought otherwise, and there have been legal actions taken in Kentucky and Ohio. For example, which led to settlements, legal settlements with Buyrider and some of its and franchisees, and out of that has come Buyrider's agreement to post the maximum prices at the dealerships. But they're still not putting them on the cars. They're
not on the window like you and I would expect to see it. And Buyrider expanding like crazy across the country, financing
right.
from Bank of America Corporation. This is not fly by night. 130 dealerships already looking at 300 or 400. Before too long, I want to begin to turn to our listeners, if I may. Amy's calling from Coventry, Connecticut. Amy, what do you think?
Oh, well, I guess I just think that big businesses preying on the poor is just unbelievably reprehensible, and I wish that there were laws against it, but I guess it's just the nature of the capitalistic culture of our country.
But that culture, that system works tremendously well in many ways. Should the poor just kind of get a grip? Should Roxanne in Albuquerque not get a car to drive to work? Should she, take a bike?
I mean, I think that there are different levels. If someone sounds like Roxanne is probably already stretched to the limit, and it sounds like she probably, doesn't have that many extras in her life, and she definitely sounds like she needs a car, and something should be done about that. And again, I wish that there were laws that protected people like that. But I also believe that there are other people who are poor, but they get sucked into the materialistic expectations of the culture.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody wants a fancy car. Everybody wants the big plasma TV. Everybody wants to go on vacations, eat out a lot, and all that kind of stuff. And I know from being poor for most of my life that I've had to sort of divorce myself from the culture of our country. I live very simply, and as a result of that, I've been able to keep my head above water.
Right, and maybe that's what it takes. Keith Epstein, let me put that to you. Now, in Roxanne's case, 103,000 miles on a 98 Saturn, not exactly a fancy car, but then Blue Hippo, one of the companies you looked at, they do a lot of business selling plasma TVs. So Amy's saying, the poor ought to get a grip. At the same time, it doesn't look good on the business side, but did you find a lot of people living large on this dangerously high debt?
I wouldn't say I found a lot of people living large on high debt. And there is people with tax preparers we talked to, for instance, another type of company we looked at. Tax preparers would talk of people who were drawn to their shop with signs in the window, basically offering very quick money, loans on anticipated tax refunds. And in some cases, realizing these people were walking in and desperate for cash to pay the landlord or to put food on the table, that sort of thing,
mm-hmm.
Or to help out a relative in trouble or a friend in trouble. Others clearly wanted to buy the latest gadget. Now, how do you divorce the idea of somebody buying a big screen TV because it's something they relish because everybody else in our society relishes it,
right?
and somebody who wants a computer, because if they can be hooked up to the internet, they can find a job better, they can be better informed.
Sure. I mean,
this can be a much more complicated area once you start parsing it.
Or maybe somebody who needs medicine for a grandchild and gets the payday loan for that. There's quite a range right there. Let's go to Nashville. And Robert, Robert, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Just wanted to comment on the, you know, the gap between the rich and the poor just keeps growing. These countries are contributing to the fact that we need a revolution. You know, our country, our government is against the poor. You know, we fight their wars. We give them half our money through taxes, and they do things like the catch and release program, where they let illegal immigrants, you know, 20 million of them here, so we can't get raises in construction because you know, they're just against us. And you know, it makes me sick to see people, you know, poor people barely surviving, having to pay these giant interest rates for things that they need.
Robert, have you seen that in your own family, among your own friends, working poor up against those very high rates?
Sure, I have. You know, to see these companies charging these giant interest rates for people that are trying to go to the grocery store, instead of our government giving people that are poor, you know, $3,000 or $4,000 tax refunds, you know, maybe they could make a different program in loaning people money or distributing that money differently to where they don't just, you know, you give a starving person a cracker, and of course they're going to freak out and go, you know, buy something. To say this lady, you know, that got this Saturn, you know, that she was at fault in any way. You know, maybe she wasn't raised properly to, you know, teach her how to handle her money. You know, maybe the government could make different programs like that. But for them not to pass laws against these companies and let them just keep devouring the poor, you know, eventually there's going to be a revolution in this country, and the poor are going to quit giving them half their money in taxes.
Robert, we hear Paul Barrett, you guys put this on the cover of Business Week. It's not exactly a typical story to go there. Did you have second thoughts about it? Is it because of this kind of concern of unrest at the bottom that you put it there?
I would have to say no, and I'd have to sort of distinguish our journalistic approach from the political analysis of your last caller. I mean, this article doesn't call for any kind of revolution, economic, political, or otherwise.
I should just mention, in Chicago today, the Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke promising the Fed will crack down on abusive mortgage lending practices. Of course, there's been a lot of hue and cry about subprime lending recently. He said they would crack down on abuses that have put millions of homeowners in jeopardy of defaulting on mortgages, quoting him here, want to ensure that lenders, quoting him, employ sound underwriting practices and make effective disclosures to consumers, but not that he would look for any specific tightening of regulations. Let's go to David in Quebec, Canada. David, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi, Tom.
Hi.
I must admit, I misrepresented my point of view. I was giving you to your person that was doing the screening. I said, well, if the poor get themselves into an 800% loan, then it's their own fault. Well, I don't agree with that. I mean, I was going to make that point, but I don't know if I can carry it out. But here's my point: is that we have a culture, a political culture, and a business culture in this country where a predatory greed is considered a high aim, and it goes right from the top, right from the administration, and which it seems to further this. The deregulation of that allowed payday lending stores to open happened under the Reagan administration, and they are literally preying on poor neighborhoods.
But what about your initial point? If it's got in effect an 800% annual percentage rate, shouldn't a consumer open their eyes wide to that and be responsible for not taking it?
Well, yes. However, some people, I mean, here, you know, there's an issue of leadership. I mean, not everyone is, you know, financially astute. I mean, I have the fortunate position in my personal life to have been raised by parents who taught me repeatedly, again and again and again, delay gratification. read, study, understand. You know, don't buy the thing that you want on impulse. Wait until you have the money, et cetera, et cetera. And I mean, to the extent now that, I mean, I don't have a television. I know people in my town that, for example, live on, I know one man who lives on $800 a month, and he's quite happy and content. He goes to the library to look at the internet and to study and to read. He visits with friends.
Right, and he's not surrounding himself with new plasma TVs he can't afford. On the other hand, maybe somebody else needs a car to get to work to make a living. David, thanks for your call. I want to go to San Diego, California right now to Steve Wedding. He is CFO and president of franchising for the used car company we were talking about that Business Week reported Roxanne Soucy buying her car from in Albuquerque. Steve Wedding is here. Mr. Wedding, thanks very much for joining us.
Hello, Tom.
So we've been reading about your business model in Business Week magazine, and it seems to be pretty successful. A lot of people without a lot of money need cars, and you're there to sell to them. But then we read the head of consumer protection for the New Mexico Attorney General's office, as reported by Business Week, saying that what you're doing is not illegal, but you're taking advantage of people. What do you say?
We are providing our customers with quality cars and professional maintenance and affordable financing. These customers need transportation to get to work. As Keith acknowledged earlier in the show, in Albuquerque, you need a car. Ms. Soucy needed a car in order to do her job. And we go to great lengths to make sure that we match customers up that with cars that will meet their needs and what they can afford.
The Business Week reported that overall your net income on the cars you own and sell is about $828, compared with $223 for cars sold as a sideline by new car dealers. Does that mean you're gouging, or you just have a better business practices?
We have a better business model, and our business model is one of vertical integration. When you look at the $231 number for the sideline franchise dealer selling used cars, that is simply his profit from selling the car. We sell the car. We provide a warranty. We provide service after the sale. Each of our dealerships have service, most of which is provided for free to the customers, and we're providing the financing to the customer.
If
so
it's such a good
business model,
we hear that's a different model and you've got a different way, but if it's so good for everybody, why don't you put the price of the car right there in the window like a normal used car lot? Why do you wait to see what the potential buyer's finances are and then give them a price?
We don't. We post a price within our store. The reason it is
right, but not in the window, not like a regular used car lot. That's a pretty big difference.
It is, but it's because we are very, very different from the typical car lot in our industry. The typical car lot in our industry sells their cars as is. They do not provide a warranty. They do not provide service after the sale. Most of them do not even have service departments on their lots. We do. And if we were to post our prices on the windows of the cars, we would not have the opportunity to explain how our program is different from the typical buy here, pay here lot that's in most major cities.
So what do you say to the kind of big critique, and it's bigger than your company here, but the big underlying critique is that we've got very sophisticated American business now turning its sights on the poor, and with an awful lot of, smarts and business savvy, sort of squeezing them for everything they can get to the point where it may be systemically unfair. What do you say to that?
Well, I can't speak to the entire, all the industries that were covered in the story, but I can tell you about ours. And we go, again, to great lengths to make sure that the customer can afford the car that they need. We're not dealing in a want situation. We're dealing in a need situation because you need a car in America to get to work.
Keith Epstein, let me ask you, these are the good guys then. Is that what you saw, Keith?
These are the good guys? What do you mean?
Well, Steve Wedding is saying, look, we're the good guys. We're getting them the car they need at a price they can afford. We're doing a service for people in this situation.
Well, there is more than one view about this. One person's apparent predation can be another person's financial salvation. People do need cars, and if they feel or don't actually have an alternative, and they need a car, and the way to get a car is to go to a local dealership and pay a 24.9% loan, interest rate loan on that car, that would seem high to some people. Perhaps even predatory to some people. Other people would regard that as balanced with the risk of doing business, which I think which I think Mr. Wedding could probably elaborate on.
Steve Wedding, it sounds high to me, but then I'm not in a situation where I need that 103,000 miles car right now. What are your business prospects? How's it look for Byrider? Does it look like a big, juicy market out there?
There are a lot of customers that need transportation and do not have alternatives that are as good as what we offer. And again, that's because most of the other dealerships sell their cars as is, don't provide service after the sale. And when our customers get a car, they need it to work. One thing I need to clear up,
Keith Yep.
said that our sophisticated systems allow us to figure out what the maximum price is that we can charge. That is a serious misconception. Our sophisticated systems allow us to sift through all the customers and determine who has the greatest likelihood to pay. Only about 35% of the applications that we receive actually go through to getting a deal. Then our procedures go further to make sure that they have the ability to make the payment. And that is where we go through all of their expenses to make sure that the payment that is being set up, not the price of the car, but the payment that is being set up for them is one that they can afford.
Of course, that didn't work out in the case that Keith came upon in Roxanne's case, 24.9% on an $8,000 loan. She thought it was $150 a month. It was $150 every 2 weeks. She couldn't do it.
Yes, and I have... We understand that our customers are not as financially savvy as maybe the rest of us on this phone call are. However, because of that, we go to great lengths also to let them know what is going to happen in terms of the contracts. We have a pre-closing video, which we offered to Brian Groh to look at, that explains the retail installment contract, all aspects of the TILA, all aspects of the amount finance disclosure. We talk about our warranty and what it covers, and we go through a six-minute video, which Ms. Sosi did watch, and then we go into the closing room and explain that contract again.
Yeah, and somehow she came away with understanding that the cost at 50% of what it was.
I understand.
Yeah.
And I don't know why she has that
yeah.
misconception,
yeah.
because we videotape with their consent our closings, and I have the videotape that shows that it was very
wow.
clearly disclosed that the payment was $150 biweekly.
It's a sophisticated business, and we see you're deep in it. Steve Wedding, President of Franchising and CFO for J.D. Byrider, thanks very much for joining us.
You're welcome. Thank you.
I want to turn now to Ann Arbor, Michigan, and Michael Barr. He's a law professor at the University of Michigan Law School, author of Banking the Poor. Michael Barr, thanks very much for joining us.
It's good to be here, Tom.
Trying to make sense of all these stories, Businessweek has done some really terrific reporting. It kind of brought an eye-opening scene, to my eyes anyway. Is this just good American business serving our lower-income fellow citizens, or is this predatory exploitation on the steroids of supercomputers and Wall Street?
Well, Tom, like the rest of us, low and moderate income people need a range of financial services. The real problem is the financial system is not well designed to serve them. There's a financial services mismatch between what the families need and what they get. And the services they do get are very expensive. Such households are often excluded from society's basic mechanisms for savings, like bank accounts and tax incentives for pension and retirement. And these same families often pay more for credit. And not only do they pay more, but this is underappreciated, I think, in the discussion so far. Mm. They often face more complicated terms and conditions of those loans than the rest of us. And that kind of financial services mismatch, I think, really leaves these families adrift.
I'm looking here. Harvard Law School professor Elizabeth Warren, quoted by Businessweek, saying it's effectively a deregulated Wild West game right now in which the bad actors drive the market. Could you and I figure out the more complicated details of these lending agreements?
I don't think so, Tom. I think if you look at the legal disclosures, and I teach these in my financial institution regulation class, they are extraordinarily complicated. And the loans that low-income people face are often more complicated than the ones that you and I do. Let me just give you a couple of examples.
Yeah.
In the home mortgage market, I just finished a study in the Detroit metropolitan area, and 23% of low-income families face a prepayment penalty on their loan. That is, if they pay it off early, they pay a penalty. That's compared to less than 2% for the loans that you and I would get in the prime market. And it's even worse if you're an African-American as opposed to if you're white. So in my study, 29% of blacks face that prepayment penalty, but only 13% of whites. And that kind of additional complication, prepayment penalties, balloon payments, teaser rates on adjustable rate mortgages, all of these kinds of provisions are complicated loan terms and conditions that are not prevalent in the prime market.
But specially designed for the poor.
That's correct.
So, I mean, I respect the business and the sophistication and savvy of American industry, but is it being harnessed here to sort of figure out every vulnerability of our poorest citizens and nail that to the wall?
I think you're exactly right, Tom. I think there's lots of things the private sector could do to serve this marketplace well, and it's really important for low-income families to get access to savings products, access to credit products that they need. It's serving low-income families is good. But we need to figure out a regulatory system that rewards the high road players, the industry people who want to do it right, and not the industry people who want to do it wrong.
What about the solution that the Department of Defense worked with Congress to come up with for American soldiers, that they just put a cap on what could be charged for payday loans? Could we do that nationally, or is that economic bad news, legal bad news? What do you think of that?
I think there's lots that the states are doing already with respect to payday lending that could be followed. So limiting the number of rollovers that people take out with payday loans. If you need a short-term loan and you get stuck in a debt trap for the rest of the year, that's not going to be good for you. So, again, in my study, more than half the people had to take out one payday loan to pay off another payday loan, and that's not a good sign. So I think limits on rollovers are an attractive idea. I think banks could really get into offering positive products for people. For example, a six-month direct debit loan product can be done at a reasonable cost for banks and is not a debt trap for the poor. So I think there's a lot the private sector could do and a lot the public sector could do.
Keith Epstein, you're a straight-up reporter, an investigative journalist, and a good one. As a citizen, how did you, or even as a business observer, how did you come away from this round of reporting thinking about this poverty business, as your headline has it?
Well, you know, any good reporter, obviously we're all human beings, and, you know, we have feelings from time to time, but any professional journalist is opening himself up to all views and presenting things in a balanced and an accurate way. I mean, what strikes me about this issue is the nuanced, complicated nature of it. There are all sorts of issues here, all sorts of questions, and you know, for instance, many of the people we talked to were very, very open about some of the bad choices they'd made in their lives. Mm. There seems to be a sort of sense of some personal responsibility.
That's good.
And also lack of knowledge, lack of awareness. At the same time, there are people who say we need a little more financial literacy out there, some more education, that sort of thing. And there's some other solutions that people talk about. I think this is a fascinating terrain, and for privilege to be able to have had this kind of look at it that takes in the whole picture. You seem rather taken with the idea that Business Week would do something like this, and yet this is good journalism, looking at the entire picture.
Absolutely,
not just.
Absolutely good journalism. Paul Barrett, do a little prognostication for us here. Does this look like a growth industry to you? Are we going to see more of Wall Street's assets and minds focused on the poverty business, as you headline it?
Well, I think we will, until inevitably the liquidity cycle changes and there's less money sloshing around looking for a place to go to work. I mean, the economy moves in cycles, and part of what lies behind this is the tremendous availability of cash that's fueling not just these poverty businesses, but also fueling the huge private equity buyouts such as the Chrysler transaction you mentioned earlier. So I think you have to be you can't expect things to stay stable. They never do.
Well, I want to thank both of you for your reporting. You lifted a curtain on quite an amazing end of the American business world. Paul Barrett, Assistant Managing Editor at Business Week, thank you for being with us.
Thanks.
And Keith Epstein, who went out in the field and did the reporting. Keith, thank you very much for that and for joining us today.
Thank you, Tom.
And Michael Barr, law professor at the University of Michigan Law School. Professor Barr, thank you very much for being here.
It was a pleasure.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.